It's not about the silver bullet of nature markets and then when we privatize these co-benefits and then private markets will solve our problems. That's not how I think about it. It's more like this transition and systemic change, right? Where nature markets can play one role of channeling private money to nature projects, which we all need.
Hey there, and welcome to Money for Change, the podcast where we discuss current developments and the role of money in creating a more balanced and just world. Of course, we want you to be part of this conversation. Head over to our website via the link in the show notes to share your thoughts or ask questions. Let's get started. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another episode for Money for Change. Imagine a world where every tree planted pays you back, not just in the shade it provides, but in a measurable value. What if by investing in a mangrove, you could both lock away carbon and protect coastal communities from storms or protection from flooding rivers through the restoration or creation of natural ecosystem? Today, the key question is, can financing nature help protect the wild places on Earth, or are we chasing a fantasy by commodifying it? Helping us answer that question is our guest, a fellow colleague of ours, Simon Scholl. And as usual, joining the conversation is Hans Stegeman. Welcome both.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yes, great to have you guys here. But before that, we're going to have Hans share some interesting news with us. What's been happening in the world recently?
As always, a lot. Last week, the Circularity Gap report came out, and that report tries to measure the circularity of the world economy. They do it already for 7 years.
Okay.
And 7 years ago, it was the 7.2% of all materials used came from recycled resources as a measure of circularity. There are more. And what do you think? Has it increased over the last 7 years, Simon?
I would have hoped, but I assume if you ask a question like this, it hasn't.
Yes, indeed. It decreased to 6.9%. While it was in a few years, it was a little bit higher. That means that more than 93% of the materials we use are still linear, extracted, used once, and then discarded and burnt. So the global material extraction has tripled over the last 50 years and now exceeds 100 billion tons each year. This is a clear link with the discussion we have on nature-based solutions.
And who's causing this? Because I had another news piece this week that the consumers are doing quite well. In France, the largest clothing retailer is Vinted, which is a second-hand clothing company.
Yeah, but France is an example where they also have taxes on fast fashion.
Interesting.
So they have quite a progressive, or at least strict policy to reduce fast fashion and discarding a lot of products and going into secondhand markets. So I think that's a good example that also gives reason to believe that if we want, we can change the system. There are examples. So this report's main conclusion was that in a circular economy will not emerge from better recycling.
Okay.
It demands system change. Mm. So a fundamental shift in how we produce, how we consume, like in your example, and also build, because there's a lot in the building environment,
where construction, we use infrastructure.
A lot of materials.
Are positive things happening also?
Of course there are positive things happening, but what we know from circular economy is this is very hard in an economy that is completely linear. So it is about transactions, and there is no incentive to go from a transaction towards a product as a service model, or to take responsibility for the resources that you have used. We talked a lot of episodes ago with Mattia, our colleagues, also about circular economy and the barriers that are there, and there the systematic barriers. And of course, there are good examples. There are also clients of ours who do really great circular stuff. But in the end, and that's also what this report shows, to get the world economy, the global economy, to move in a more circular direction, that's really hard. And there is a link with resources and nature, of course, because this is land use, this is resource use, this is scarce material use, which is currently destroying nature. So it is very important that we try to move towards a circular economy.
But also very social because of that mindset shift.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, what else did you see in the news this week?
A totally different topic about green investments. Green investment funds in Europe are not as clean as they seem.
What a surprise.
What a surprise. A joint investigation of Vox Europe and The Guardian reveals that funds marketed under the EU's sustainable finance rules, so we know it, Emma knows it, sustainable finance, the SFDR,
Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation.
But still, funds classified as Article 8, that's sustainable, and Article 9, that's more impact. Our funds are Article 9. They still invest heavily in fossil fuel giants like Shell, BP, and ExxonMobil, companies responsible for nearly one-fifth of global carbon emissions. This is not prohibited at the moment.
No.
So they're not doing anything wrong. It's only that clients might have a different idea.
I totally agree with this. So there is regulation to disclose the extent to which you invest according to a sustainable investment objective or how you consider sustainable aspects. There is no minimum standard. So what you get is, you know, you can invest in the best of the fossil fuel companies, and that's still a sustainable strategy. There are coming regulations on the names of funds. So that's a greenwashing risk so that clients or, you know, retail investors are not harmed by this. But this is absolutely a very prominent issue with the regulations that have been introduced.
Yeah, and we have always taken a stance as Triodos on this regulation and what should be done.
Currently writing one as we speak as well. Yeah.
And Simon, you're also working on it at investment management or for investment management partly
with
investment management. I think all our funds are Article 9.
Yeah.
And I know we don't invest in fossil.
Yeah.
So even if the rules change, we don't have to change anything in our funds?
No, I think our minimum standards are already a few steps beyond what kind of is the baseline for these regulations. But again, it's really about disclosure. There's no minimum requirement that you need to exclude things. Hopefully in the future, that is definitely what we're advocating for.
But given the political environment, it's questionable if that will be a success.
Yeah.
Anna, we should be positive here.
We keep going, we keep going, because your third piece of news is something with the politics.
It's with politics. So the U.S. credit rating cuts. So Moody's has, as the last rating agency, downgraded the U.S. government's credit score, which is a sign of growing concern about how much the country is borrowing and spending, with a deficit forecasted at 9% of the U.S. government and a debt of 120% of GDP. This is unprecedented. And those rating agencies still say this is a strong economy, but the policy is not so sustainable in a financial sense. Mm-hmm. So they downgraded it. And it's the first time in history that the U.S. has lost its top rating from all three major credit agencies. Of course, Trump was angry. No news. And there's also a reason for him, because he pushed still for a big tax and spending plan that could add trillions to national debt. And so the tax idea is to tax the rich less or even extend the plan that was already in place. And another part of the plan was to raise taxes through trade tariffs, which is not playing out that well
because
he's starting to negotiate and to postpone part of it. And for me, this is also a reality check, I think, for the Trump presidency. So I have a lot of comments on markets.
Yeah.
But financial markets have value. They discipline, in this sense, a U.S. government or a U.S. president who is doing not so smart.
Okay, because that was going to be my question. Is this going to even have an effect on what Trump does or think? Well, maybe not think, but what he does and the plans
that go
through.
I think so. That's what we've seen over the last few weeks, that in the end, markets determine for part also still his policies. He's not listening to financial markets as in his first presidency, that if the stock market went down, that he was really looking only at that. So it's a little bit more longer term.
Mm-hmm.
But especially what we now see, the long-term interest rates on U.S. debt, on U.S. treasuries, is rising. So that means higher government expenditure on interest rates, on interest. And that is a problem. And the problem in the end is the trust in the dollar. And if we go there, then, well, his room to maneuver will be very limited. And he also understands that that is not the best idea.
Mm. All right. That was it for the news this week.
Interesting.
Thank you for that. Now let's get to the key question. The key question is, can financing nature help protect the wild places on Earth, or are we chasing a fantasy by commodifying it? Is it just a distraction from real action? Simon, your role as commercial strategist in the nature-based solutions market has really set you up perfectly to answer this question with us. In your role, I understand you identify and develop finance opportunities with environmental or social impact. You build internal and external partnerships. You shape the long-term nature-based solution strategy of Triodos Bank, all with the goal of bridging finance and nature for a healthier planet. Can you tell us, what is financing nature? How is it different from regular green investing?
Perfectly summarized what I do, so really nice.
Oh, you did it yourself.
So, you called it nature finance, or how we call it at Triodos, nature-based solutions, financing nature-based solutions. And yeah, in my simple terms, how I would describe it is basically using the means of a financial institution. So this is mainly money, of course, also a bit of expertise, but mainly using capital to restore, enhance, or protect ecosystems. This can be forests, this can be wetlands, this can be different type of ecosystems, and changing actually the activity which is happening there, so the land use, that it in the end benefits, right? It has positive outcomes on climate mitigation, for example, for nature, but also for people. So this is always the three things when we look at it holistically as Triodos. It's always people, it's nature, and it's climate mitigation. So that's what I would qualify nature-based solutions. And then green investments on the other side. And it's not the other side. It's just like similar space, but it's more about doing less harm, right? Nature-based solution is more about doing positive things and going beyond doing less harm. And green investing is doing less harm. And it really relates quite good to what you said earlier, Hans, right? So it needs to be then strong green investment, and it's not here either or. We need green investments, and we need to reduce harm in the first place and stop the destruction of ecosystems. And then only after that, nature-based solution often comes in. That's okay. About the restoration and the positive effects.
Is that true? Because sometimes I think nature-based solutions can be also to protect.
That was going to be my question. Yeah. You said something like changing the activity on the land that's happening. What do you mean by that?
That's a very good point. So it really depends how I look at it, right? So when I say nature-based solution in the sense of doing something or doing not something anymore, right? So for example, projects we are doing, we are just stopping doing any activity, right? There was before, let's say, a farming activity on the ground or any other activity, for example, a forest which was used for timber production.
Okay,
if we stop doing an activity, then it's also nature-based and has positive impacts for example, for biodiversity. But it also can be the nature conversation of things, right? So it exactly has already a very important state for nature and biodiversity.
Yeah, this might sound very philosophical, but it always starts with what is your baseline. So
exactly.
if you say the baseline is it was destroyed and we're going to repair it, or it is not destroyed yet, so we're going to protect it.
Exactly, yeah.
What is then restoration still? That's maybe not so interesting, but it is to keep in mind, well, what is the difference between doing less bad and doing good?
No, it's a very important thing. And that's also a discussion we also have often. What is nature-based solutions and what is the alternative scenario and what is the baseline, which often comes as part of this nature-based solution projects.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's a very valid question, but maybe just let's take a step back to the listeners, because some of them might not be all that well-versed in this topic. How do you actually go about putting a price tag on a forest or wetland? You've mentioned the ecosystem services. How do you go about pricing that? And how do you make that also interesting for investors?
Yeah, that's a good point. So let's try to use it with an example, right? So for example, let's say you are a forest owner and you have a piece of land and now you plan to restore this piece of nature. And
Let's say reforest.
So you have a part of land and you want to reforest it.
Reforest it.
Because in the past it was used for timber.
For example.
Okay,
or
perfect.
let's be more precise. In Germany we have planted, or forest owners have planted, quite a lot of spruce for decades. Now they are attacked by climate change and bark beetle, and there's more or less degraded or destroyed land, and now they have this empty piece of land, and now they have to do something there. So they could do, again, plant spruce and monocultures and do it that way. Probably not the smartest decision to do it that way. Or they can look at what kind of, land activity can I create there, which do not only produce timber, but also has other benefits. For example, storing carbon long-term for climate mitigation, or provide habitats for different insects, for different birds, and for different species. This was always a very important role of forests, but it hasn't been really like get you an income.
And so nature-based solutions or financing nature then puts a value on the storing of carbon, the biodiversity through the creation of these things called biodiversity credits as well as carbon credits.
For example. So that's more or less the way how it does. For like you do this activity and then you need some robust data and some robust measurement. And let's stay with a simple example, carbon. Then you project how much carbon is stored there and then you need to prove it. And then you say, let's say there's 1,000 tons of carbon is stored. And then there are third parties like certifications and standards. And then you can certify this and turn it into credits, in that context, carbon credits. And then you can sell it on the market. Can talk a bit more why people are willing to pay for this, but more or less that's how it works. You can, what had no value before, can get a value now. Often it's carbon, but it can also be biodiversity.
So in the past, you know, where the trees were valued for the timber they were able to provide, now the trees are also valued for the positive impacts they have on nature.
For all the co-benefits. It's not, it's the clean air, it's cleaning water. The forest gives you so much. And now a few things are getting like also an income stream, mainly carbon, but there are much more things which still are a public good and are there for free. But now we have something right next to timber, exactly where it can generate an income stream.
You mentioned public goods. I'm an economist.
That's your topic.
Of course, I can understand that if you can create a carbon or an income stream from carbon and someone wants to buy it, that helps to make it affordable so to have a project there. But should we go there? Like you said, a forest in this case has so many benefits, which are public goods. And we've learned from a long history in economics that public goods should not be privatized always because it helps to keep the public goods public. So why should private investors use money to restore forest? Why is this a public good, not a public task? Why should we go there?
And then I agree, right? So that's not something where I would disagree. It's more or less how I see it. There's a lot of ends what we have to do all together, right? So it's not about the silver bullet of nature markets. And then when we privatize these co-benefits and then private markets will solve our problems. That's not how I think about it. It's more like this transition and systemic change, right? Where nature markets can play one role of channeling private money to nature projects, which we all need. But that comes a bit for me, not in the end, but like not with the first priority. Priority number one is really like stop doing bad things, right? Like subsidies, but also all the money flowing from financial institutions in harmful activities. So stop that, regulate that. And then also companies, when they want to do a nature project, that shouldn't be a license to pollute.
Exactly, that was going to be my thought.
A way that, and there are many companies out there who have like transition paths on their own, right? They want to have a more sustainable business model and they want to change and they want to transform. And part of that transition in the end can also be to support nature projects. And if there are nature markets, like to channel this private money in, for us and for us as Triodos, but also for us as teams, it's super important that there's really strict rules, right? And there is a lot of voluntary markets out there now and the rules are changing and they are not having the high same standards. We are more or less in favor also having more compliance markets there. That's the regulator sets some standards out there. So it's not like the don't do it at all, but it's part of a solution in a bigger picture.
Yeah. Exactly. So if you have any kind of very polluting company come up to a forestry project or a nature-based solutions project wanting to buy lots of carbon credits or nature credits, they should also have actual plans and actions to also reduce the negative harm.
100%. And that's how we do it, right? Just to say, like, it's not only words. It's really like we have internal rules and policies and guidelines following that. If we want to approach a nature-based solution project, we look at both ends. We look at who buys the carbon credits out of these projects. And there we put ourselves some rules that these needs to be companies who are not destroying nature or polluting or need to be on a transition path. But also for the projects itself, we have our minimum standards and our criteria. And we also develop guidelines for each ecosystem in the end, where we say that's a good project.
Which is great. And I think Triodos Bank is kind of more the gold standard aspect on the whole spectrum. But I mean, is this normal in the market where there's this much due diligence with these projects and the buyers of these credits? Because there's definitely been some criticism in the past of certain regimes or certain credits. How do you see that risk happening in the market?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's one of the first things. If people are not 100% familiar with the market, they often refer to Guardian or the Zeit articles. And it's super valid and it's super important that we talk about that, right? So there were, in the past, there were a lot of projects which were poorly designed. So there were money which went into the projects in general, didn't reach the project on the ground or the people who were benefiting from it. So it was more lost on the way towards the project. And also there was a huge overestimation of carbon credits coming out of these projects. So a lot of things have happened in these markets. And like, I would say, is it like sure that only good projects are now still on the market or will come to the market? No. So I don't think it's perfect yet. In particular, as long as it's a voluntary market quite often, so there is no regulated standard. Mm-hmm. But for example, the European Union is working on a kind of a standard for the European Union. Article 6 of the Paris Agreement is now getting more standards how this is going to work. So there is a lot of things are happening.
Yeah.
It's improving. And like the kind of projects we are looking at, of course, as they are the gold standard, but of course, it's not perfect yet. There's still some way for improvement.
But is it easy or is it possible to find then the right projects? Because so we're strict and we have opinions about everything. I know it. I'm also partly the cause of it maybe sometimes. But is it still possible to find the right projects then?
That's my job.
That's why I ask you.
And that's why like I can tell you, no, it's not super easy. Because I would say that what we see quite often then, because we are living in this dilemma that once in a while, they have a really, really good impact case. You still, we are a bank and we are a commercial bank and we still need to earn some interest. So it's often that I see fantastic projects that come out of this world of grant financing and like they have a great case, but don't have a revenue model.
Yeah.
So we are in this like blended finance world, public-private partnership world, where we have to find projects which still have this very good impact case and still already have developed the revenue model, which is like for us doable and financeable. And that's not easy. So, and where we see this is happening, for example, is, just used this example recently, is projects in the UK where the markets are more advanced and where there are compliance schemes for biodiversity and carbon markets. This makes for us much easier to say what are good projects and there's a revenue source and income stream generated based on this.
And can you just quickly recap kind of what those different revenue sources are? Is it only carbon credits, biodiversity credits?
No, that's what we try to avoid, I wouldn't say, but like often it's not like this. So we try to have like a diversified income stream. So this can be a mix of payment for ecosystem services or like carbon credits or biodiversity credits. Mm-hmm. That's what we just talked about. So you can do a project and get an income stream from carbon credits. But often there's also ecotourism is often an important aspect. Clamping, for example, then on the ground. So that also involves the people who could work there or from the wider community who spend their holiday there. And often, in particular, in organic regenerative agriculture projects, it's also part of selling the goods. So we can also sell, for example, organic regenerative oranges to the end consumer. And so it's always a mix where we have to find a good balance because solely on carbon credits is hard to finance.
This reminds me really about what we talked in the beginning about circular economy, that you also see that you need a combination of different kind of business models to make it work and to have a revenue stream that's good enough in the current economic environment to finance it. And I think that's really valuable to work on that and to see how we can improve it. But it's also a very long journey, I think.
It is. And of course, when we start, we also had this vision, ambition that like it can be similar to renewable energy and then we will only sell carbon credits and this can be the main income stream. We are looking to that, but still it's not there yet.
What's the average length that these projects take to complete or before you get the first kind of revenue streams?
Nature determines that in the end.
So nice.
Because these projects, it's a nature, like, look at the reforestation project in Germany before the trees are growing, and like it takes decades, right? So often the project time is 30 years.
Yeah.
That's also why we as a bank have to look at these projects a little bit different and take longer time horizons. And in particular, in the first couple of years, you don't get the income stream because trees are still quite small.
Yeah.
That's why you have to adjust.
So this is really also a paradigm or a mindset shift from using land to grow and extract the resources on it to also conserving. I know in our talks beforehand, you also made a mention of protecting land and restoring land. Mm-hmm. Yeah, how does that work? Because that then brings me to my question. Okay, if you're measuring your impact, it would almost show that you're doing better if you restore land. So you just take destroyed land and you restore it, than if you were to conserve land. How does that weigh up against each other?
Yeah, also very valid point. And that's also one of the dilemmas in there. If you again look at forest projects and the projects which were most heavily criticized in the past were forest conservation projects, so-called Red Plus projects, because for them it's much more difficult coming back to the baseline. So what would have happened otherwise?
Yeah.
It's more easy in the end to say, look, there's like a plain piece of land and now you plant trees there and now you can measure the improvement in terms of, for example, carbon stored on this piece of land. So yeah, we often it's more easier to monitor and to track a restoration project or a reforestation project than doing like a conservation project because of this baseline issue.
Yeah.
Even though it's more important or equally important, probably even more important, and then there's public good and like public money angle comes in there.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because what's the income stream of conservation? I think that's the biggest problem.
Yeah.
And they tried to do it, but of course, you saw all the downsides of it.
Yeah.
Whereas we know older forests, ancient forests hold a lot of biodiversity benefits than a young forest with, you know, less diversity in it.
Absolutely.
Interesting. All right. Is it scalable? My last question. It sounds amazing, but my question is this scalable? Can we really make big strides to ensure biodiversity protection? What do you think?
Yes, again, in its niche, right? Not as the one scalable solution to save our planet, but yeah, there are elements that it can be scalable. And I was just last week talked about at the OECD workshop where different governments discussed how this can be scalable. And one key element, and here again, I don't want to advocate constantly for government and regulation, but like, yeah, voluntary markets didn't prove to make it scalable. So we are active in different markets. And I mentioned before the UK market or England, there they have some regulations in place where some legal enforcement is behind that. So that's where money can flow into a market where there's legal certainty and where there's policies and frameworks. In the other EU countries, it's not the case yet. And there we don't see scalability in that same level as we see it in England, for example. So yes, it can be scalable. And right next to rules and regulations, what I feel is really important, and we work with a lot of public partners, is public-private partnerships. It's not a 100% private thing. And also public wants to work with private money in particular. And that's where in this, I would say, niche we are working together and leveraging, for example, public knowledge, public money, and then bringing in our private angle on top of it. So these are two very important scalable actions.
Yeah, I think it's very important to recognize it. Yes, there is some space for private money to restore nature, to work on nature-based solutions, but it is partly public goods. So there is at least a place, like you said, for strict regulation on what is good and what is not good. And yes, blended finance can be a solution, but it also has to be very strict regulated, because that's what I'm always thinking. Private capital has only one thing most of the time that they want to do, is to make the highest return.
Yep.
And the highest return and restoring nature is not the best combination in itself.
And if you have only, for example, one metric, that's also one of the challenges. So like, let's say if then a private actor only optimizes a project for carbon and doesn't look at all the other...
Not holistically.
And because, we can generate carbon credits. Let's optimize it for carbon and then to eucalyptus monoculture because it has the most carbon content.
Yeah, yeah.
That's also don't, what we not want. So that's why.
Eucalyptus monoculture, I like it.
Yeah, and I think another podcast we covered this with impact measurement is don't add all them all up together. You have to look at them individually and understand the holistic impact that you have.
Mm.
To wrap up, the key question, can financing nature help humanity save the planet, or is it just a distraction from real action? Hans, what would you answer with?
I think it can help under strict conditions, as I said before, but we should not think, as some governments do, that private finance can solve the issues that there are. So it can help, but it is not a substitution for regulation, for public money, etc.
Yeah. And we see that also with the sustainable finance regulations. Regulation needs to be strict, clear, and really with the aim of improving these biodiversity areas.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Simon. One last closing question. What would you do with 10 billion euros to change the world?
Since I know you asked me this question early already, yeah. I could prepare
a little
bit.
You a little
no,
bit.
Thanks. The day you asked me, I saw a trailer of the new documentary of Sir David Attenborough called Ocean.
Yep.
And there was one sentence which really stuck in my head, and it was like, I'm living 400 years on this planet already, and like I just started to realize how important oceans are and how important our water is. And I think that's something which is, of course, it's on the radar screen and on the agenda, but it's once in a while a bit overlooked. So I would use the money for protecting maritime areas and oceans, in particular, so many biodiversity hotspots. Mm-hmm. And there's also quite a bit of proof that they can recover rather quickly. So I would use this 10 billion euro for protecting marine ecosystems.
Is that also a market that you're exploring as well?
From a commercial perspective, not yet. Very simply, it's even more difficult to find business cases there, right?
Interesting.
Yeah. So even more public money is needed there than on land.
Yeah, so you have your 10 billion to put in.
There.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's only just like a little bit of what is needed.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, Simon, for joining.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Hans, again for being here. And for those listening, thank you for tuning in. And we hope you stay tuned for the next episode of Money for Change.
That's a wrap for this episode of Money for Change. We hope you found today's conversation insightful and inspiring as we continue to explore the transitions that are shaping our world and our future. If you enjoyed what you heard, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for tuning in to Money for Change.